Welcome to Talking History. This is Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Proponents of religion and technology have often been at odds in history, especially when they view their own or the other's supposed benefits for life on Earth. But are religion and technology necessarily incompatible, and have they always been at odds? That's the subject of today's interview featuring historians Eileen Dugan and David Noble. But before we get to that, let's look back at a key event from this week in history. During this week in 1943, Norman Rockwell's famous portrait of Rosie the Riveter muscled its way onto the cover of the Saturday Evening Post. As part of a government effort to recruit women into the labor force, Rosie called on women to roll up their sleeves and go to work. And go to work they did. Between 1940 and 1945, the number of women employed outside the home increased by 50%. They became pilots, metal and assembly line workers, and welders. Many jobs men had done before the war became the responsibility of women. But such a necessary shift in the sphere of women's work challenged the traditional views of the place of women. Columnist Max Lerner expressed typical fears when he wrote that the war was developing a new Amazon who could outdrink, outswear, and outswagger the men. To overcome such deep prejudices and fears among both men and women and to meet the pressing needs of industry, the American government carried out a massive propaganda drive led by Norman Rockwell's Rosie the Riveter. Turning to items of interest in the news, administrators of Yad Vashem, Israel's Holocaust Memorial, recently began a massive effort to collect the names of the nearly 3 million Holocaust victims that have not yet been recorded. Holocaust survivors and the friends and families of those who perished at the hands of the Nazis are being asked to provide written testimonials regarding the fate of their loved ones. Since announcing the drive and setting up a web page and phone service, Yad Vashem has been receiving inquiries for forms at the rate of about 650 an hour. The pages of testimony will serve as death certificates for the victims. The Nazis did not keep records of those they killed. In Rome, archaeologists digging on one of the city's seven ancient hills recently discovered the 2,800-year-old tomb of a child. Complete with a skull, pelvic bone, thigh bone, and terracotta and ceramic vases, the tomb is one more piece of evidence that Capitoline Hill was inhabited before the legendary founding of Rome by Romulus and Remus in 753 BC. You're listening to Talking History. The world seems to be divided these days between those who predict the ultimate triumph of technology over religion and those who believe that a resurgence of religion is the only way by which mankind will be saved from himself. But that has long been the divide among the peoples of the world. So what about religion and technology? Are they incompatible? What perspective does history offer us on that question? Here to explore those questions and more on the history of religion and technology are Eileen Dugan and our special guest today, David Noble.
It is often assumed in modern society that religion and technology are by their very natures incompatible. It is an extension of the age-old conflict between faith and reason, we say. But is this actually the case? Is it possible that, over the century, religious thought has actually played an important role in the advancement of technology? Could the goals of new technologies actually include the spiritual? With us today to discuss the relationship of religion and technology is Dr. David F. Noble, professor of history at York University in Toronto, and currently the Hickson Riggs visiting professor at Harvey Mudd College. Dr. Noble is a past curator of modern technology at the Smithsonian Institution and is the author of The Religion of Technology, The Divinity of Man, and the Spirit of Invention. Welcome, Professor Noble.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Today in our society, we seem to be in the grips of millennium fever. And in your book, you discuss how the pursuit of the millennium actually is connected to the rise of Western technology.
Right. Well, actually, we're at a moment of irony right now. On the one hand, enthusiasm, the obsession with the year 2000, and many people seeing it as the millennium from the Book of Revelation, actually without much justification, but that's an association people are making. And at the same time, there's a an equal obsession with technology, and this is all coming sort of to a head with the Y2K bug. Many people see the Y2K as a kind of divine retribution for the hubris that humans have displayed recently. The perception of computers and the powers that come from computers as being almost godlike. And there are some, especially pronounced in the United States, where millenarianism has always been very strong, there is this almost an expectation, a gleeful expectation in the calamity that will ensue when the Y2K bug hits and shuts off our power and all these other things. And so we're living in a very interesting moment here.
Now, in your book, you talk about how the fall of man and the ideas of wishing to regain again that perfection that we had in the Garden of Eden was actually a spur to many in terms of early technology.
Right. Well, in the book, what I'm doing is tracing what I'm calling the religion of technology, which really is about 1,000 years old. In the first millennium, the first 1,000 years of the Christian era, most Orthodox Christians held the classical view that the useful arts, what we now call technology, was really a lowly activity associated with manual labor and slavery and with women as well. And so it wasn't really given much attention, but more important, it wasn't at all associated with the main project of Christianity, which is redemption, salvation, recovery of lost perfection. And around the 9th and 10th centuries, for reasons that are not altogether clearly understood, the useful arts become implicated in this project of redemption. So what I'm doing is tracing that story about how the major myths of our Western society, and the West is really defined originally as Latin Christendom. We're talking about Christian myths. And the myths, as you mentioned, have to do with the recovery of paradise. And the assumption was that among Christian theologians was that Adam had a share in divine knowledge, that is, knowledge about nature, and enjoyed dominion over creation, and also participated in creation, symbolized by the naming of the beast in Genesis, and also enjoyed eternal existence, immortality. All of this was forfeited with the fall. And the idea, the promise of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, that redemption is in the offing for mankind, meaning a recovery of those lost powers. So in the 9th and 10th century, when the useful arts become implicated, primarily under the auspices of monks, the idea was that by developing the sciences and the arts, or science and technology as we call it today, human beings are restoring, recovering what they originally were, their original birthright, and approximating the powers that had been lost, and anticipating, and this is crucial for millenarianism, anticipating this total recovery of our angelic status, our divinity, with the coming of the millennium. And the millennium is, again, from the last book of the New Testament, the book of Revelation, a 1,000-year period following the return of the Messiah, in which the saints, or the righteous, will reign with Christ for 1,000 years. That's where the word millennium comes from. And that's sort of a collective redemption for the first, as in the book of Revelation, for the first to be redeemed. And so starting in about 1,000 years ago, the useful arts, as I said, became implicated in this story. And again, we see the promoters of technology talking in these terms, that what we're doing is recovering what we have lost and also preparing for the millennium in which we will indeed be restored to our original perfection.
And this pursuit of paradise even extended to exploration. I remember back in 1992, there was that Christopher Columbus film with Gerard Depardieu subtitled The Conquest of Paradise, and we all thought that that was just a nifty title. But you make the point that Columbus really thought that he had found the new biblical paradise, and that's part of what he had been seeking.
Right. Well, I mean, just to put the context, put this in context, in the 11th century, there was an abbot by the name of Joachim of Fiore who reinterpreted millenarianism in such a way as to make it historical and to give human beings some role, some agency in preparing for and bringing about the millennium. And he had identified a vanguard, the weary spiritualis of spiritual men, who would, through contemplation and evangelizing, help bring about this the kingdom of God. And at first it was the monks, the Cistercians especially, and then the baton was passed to the Franciscans, especially the spiritual Franciscans, the friars. And then the explorers, especially Columbus, bore that mantle. And Columbus was very much influenced by this tradition, and he was a Joachimite millenarian, which was very, very widespread at the time in Spain. And so he believed quite firmly that he had been sent by prophecy, and in fact explained this in great detail to his patrons, the king and queen of Spain. And this is where he got his chutzpah, his courage, his confidence to do what he did, because he believed that it had been preordained. He was the Christopherens, the Christ bearer, and he would bear the Christ, the message, the gospel, to the new world. And the new world was, in his view, he called it the terrestrial paradise, the paradise that had been lost. And indeed, many among the early explorers, especially the Franciscans, viewed the natives of these new lands as the lost tribe of Israel. And in the millenarian mythology, the conversion of the Jews, and these people are now identified as Jews, is the a prerequisite for the millennium. So Columbus saw himself as the bearer of this tradition. And it's this aspect of his experience has been downplayed, but it's really central.
How did Freemasonry bring the religion of technology into modern times?
Okay, again, just to carry the story up until the 18th century and 17th century, I mean the friars and the explorers gave rise to a fervent belief that the study of nature would restore human beings to their original perfection and purify Christianity. And this is the story of the Renaissance Magi and the Rosicrucians. And the vanguard, the main promoters of science and technology at the time were fueled by this expectation. And this carries into the 17th century, the so-called period of the Scientific Revolution, when most of the leading figures, Robert Boyle, Isaac Newton, were equally inspired. And Newton, for example, spent much of his life trying to understand ancient writings, and he believed that all he was doing was really restoring human knowledge, not discovering anything new. He tried feverishly to date when the millennium would begin, etc. The Freemasons come in the 18th century, and they have their origins in the Rosicrucian Brotherhood of the 17th century. And they carry this forward into the Age of Enlightenment. The Freemasons, their lore is very much in this spirit that Adam, the Freemason constitutions begin with the words, Adam, our first parent. Eve is never mentioned. That's a very important part of the story, too, the gender aspect of this whole story, mythology. But the Masons, the Freemasons were the main promoters of the industrial arts in the 18th and into the 19th century in the United States. Development of engineering as an institution, the development of engineering education, especially in France, the Ecole Polytechnique, and the other leading institutions, all were the creations of the Freemasons. So in my story, the Freemasons are carrying this mythology into what is often seen, thought to be a more secular age, the Age of Enlightenment.
To bring the story a little further forward, you talk about how even the creators of the atomic bomb would use creation and apocalyptic imagery to describe their work, such as the Trinity test.
Right. And Oppenheimer, who was a Jew, is using a quintessentially Christian notion, the Trinity, which he later remembered that it had come from some poems of John Donne, the 17th century metaphysical poet. So what I'm trying to argue here is that there are deep-seated cultural, shared cultural norms and impulses that are moving us, and we're not very much aware of it. In the 19th century, especially the second half of the 19th century, some of this millenarian expectation was dulled somewhat following the Second Great Awakening, the largest mass movement in American history. And gave way to an idea of infinite progress rather than some end time and final judgment. But with the horrors of World War I and especially World War II and especially the atomic bomb, this godlike power of destruction, the apocalyptic expectations returned with a vengeance. And many within the scientific community shared them and believed themselves to be like gods, wielding a power of destruction, which again, from the Book of Revelation, is a power of redemption as well. That is, salvation through destruction.
We only have a moment remaining, but perhaps you could say in conclusion, you discuss in your conclusion that perhaps the convergence between religion and technology has outlived its historical usefulness. How so? And what do you think is to follow?
Well, what I'm saying there very quickly is the hallmark technologies of our age, manned spaceflight, genetic engineering, artificial intelligence, all betray an impatience with life, an impatience with our mortal conditions and mortal limits. And I think there's a real menace here, because it leads to a disregard for our mortal needs. We can get into our spaceships and get out of here and really abandon the planet to its fate. We can download our minds into machines, silicon-based machines, and move into the post-biological civilization and essentially transcend our mortal needs. All of this I see as very dangerous. Escapist, and what I'm urging is that we overcome our otherworldly proclivities and embrace anew our earthly condition.
Thank you, Professor Noble.
My pleasure.
We have been talking with Dr. David F. Noble, author of The Religion of Technology, The Divinity of Man, and The Spirit of Invention.
The impeachment of President Bill Clinton and his trial before the United States Senate are now history. Historians have already taken up their pens to assess the damage. But what effect has this traumatic event had on the American people, or, in the case of our op-ed of the week, on the nation's college students? Here to discuss his students' reactions to this national crisis is Matthew Pinsker, professor of United States history at Millersville University. Professor Pinsker is also a senior partner at Jack Burden & Associates, a professional research firm that analyzes historical trends in politics and public policy. He has titled his op-ed for today, Checks and Bounces.
Students sometimes write the darndest things. A freshman in my U.S. History Survey course recently criticized FDR's notorious court-packing scheme in an exam essay, arguing that the plan would have upset our constitutional system of checks and bounces. After watching the bizarre history of the Clinton impeachment crisis unfold during this past year, I was hard-pressed to correct her slip. My reluctance only intensified as I read the rest of her classmates' dark views on the evolution of our politics and society. Teaching American history at the end of the American century has become an uneasy experience in a classroom full of college students who seem practically repulsed by our Republican experiment in self-government. No doubt there is a litany of causes for this alienation, but nothing has solidified the disdain so much as the current obsession with Washington scandals. William Bennett might write about the death of outrage, but he should read the Blue Book essays I just finished grading. My students seem to have almost boundless outrage against the President, the Congress, the Independent Counsel, and the press, against nearly anything associated with politics. Throughout this year, I made a conscious decision to emphasize the myth of the innocent past and the ultimate soundness of democratic self-government. Things are never as bad as they seem, I frequently told my students, and usually the American people and their representatives find the right solutions. Frankly, I expected to read platitudes more or less identical to those sentiments in the exam essays that I received. However, I was stunned by the responses to a question on the changing relationship between politicians and the media during the 20th century. My students unleashed venom that directly contradicted my affirmations of the democratic faith. It is part of a politician's job, one upperclassman wrote, to be dishonest. Another was even blunter. Politicians have been and will continue to be liars. One student was even more explicit. Politicians are still not honest, politically or sexually. Yet another bemoaned the constant lies of American presidents. At least one respondent was convinced that things were better now, although not exactly for the most noble reasons. I think politicians are still the same, she wrote. They just can't get away with things like they used to. Many students piled onto the media, armed with recent lessons about the yellow journalists and muckrakers of an earlier age. The media has been more and more interested in scandal rather than foreign relations or political news, sighed one disgruntled freshman. Another equally cynical teenager offered this bit of wisdom. Though politicians have always had some crooks among their ranks, clearly the worst of it is past us, if only the media would let us believe it. Despite a course of near indoctrination about the joys of the Constitution, this surly focused group of students repudiated their professor and exhibited clear evidence that the worst fallout from these scandals might not be felt for years to come. Forget about current job approval ratings. The question is, will future leaders approve of the job itself?
You've been listening to Matthew Pinsker, professor of United States history at Millersville University and senior partner at Jack Burden & Associates, a professional research firm that analyzes historical trends in politics and public policy. And this is Talking History. Summer and summer vacations will soon be upon us, and you will no doubt be looking for a lovely, historic spot to visit. Here to describe one such spot is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Alexandria, Virginia is the perfect historic spot to visit this summer. The Northern Virginia city is celebrating its 250th anniversary, and lots of events are planned for the rest of 1999. There are plenty of reasons to celebrate in Alexandria, and all will keep you very busy. In addition to the dozen or so small museums and historic sites, there are 50 antique and fine arts galleries and hundreds of specialty shops, along with more than 200 restaurants. Even though most people think of colonial history when they think of Alexandria, one of the most popular sites to visit is the Torpedo Factory Art Center, where torpedoes were manufactured between World War I and World War II.
Thank you, Cindy. And those who are tempted to visit historic Alexandria might consider adding to their itineraries the following opportunities in the same area to learn more about George Washington, the bicentennial of whose death we mark this year. In Richmond, Virginia, the Virginia Historical Society is offering the exhibit George Washington, the Man Behind the Myths. The exhibit compares how artists and writers have glorified the nation's first president over the past 200 years since his death. to the actual historical records using manuscripts, portraits, and other historical objects. The Octagon Museum in Washington, D.C. has an exhibit on George Washington as architect. The exhibit, which is open until July 4th, examines Washington's self-taught architectural flair, as well as his ideas on the building of his home, Mount Vernon, and the U.S. Capitol. And the National Portrait Gallery, also in the nation's capital, is currently featuring the presidential portraits of George Washington. The exhibit, which closes on August 8th, delves into the character and personality of the man as revealed through some 25 portraits. Be sure to call ahead for more specific information on each of these exhibits. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed our program and that you'll join us next week for our special Memorial Day show. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. And until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau. Thank you.